when we're looking at the Haredi sector, they're growing much more, exponentially more than the secular and religious Zionist sectors. With this demographic reality in front of us, we need to understand that if they do not take part in military service, and also if they do not take part in the economic sector, then Israel won't be able to be the same state economically. We won't be the startup nation. We won't have the same economic strength that we have right now. We won't have the same army that we have right now. And when we understand the threats Israel is facing, if Israel cannot be strong economically and cannot have a strong army, then Israel cannot be. And therefore, I understand that this is an existential issue. And on existential issues, from day one, I decided that I'll put a red line. And even if my party goes the other way, then I'll make it very clear that I'm gonna put a red line and say that political considerations can be the reason we say okay to existential threats.
Hey, Lav, how are you doing?
Good. A lot to talk about this week.
This morning at the Miskav Institute, I met with Mary Ben Shabbat, with the ambassador of a very important Asian country. And the ambassador started off by saying, so how's everything? And we just started laughing. I don't know. We're definitely not in the calm before the storm. Maybe we're in the storm before the hurricane, maybe.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, some of our listeners may have known, I think I mentioned it before, that I'm very heavily pregnant at this point. And when I heard Trump say 3-week ceasefire, I was like, okay, I'm probably going to have this baby during the ceasefire. I'm not going to have to choose my hospital based on which has the best, protected rooms for women giving birth. But, right. There's still a lot to talk about what's going on during this 3-week ceasefire.
No, I was actually speaking to an ex-oncologist whose offices are sort of 3 floors underground, and they moved the maternity ward in his hospital to that same floor because of the rockets that were falling in central Israel. And a baby was born, and they said, Mazal Tov, this is the first baby ever born in an oncology ward. It's a little bit sad, but it's kind of our reality.
Well, I know people who've given birth basically in parking lots because they've converted a lot of the underground parking lots into hospital wards. And some of the hospitals, like the Rambam Hospital, which is the big hospital in Haifa, their entire hospital is rocket safe. And they did that after the 2006 Second Lebanon War. And there's also a hospital in Ashdod, which is out of the range of the smallest, the standard Hamas rockets, but it's still quite close, just for our listeners to understand. And it's I think the newest hospital in Israel. It's pretty new. And they also made the whole place rocket proof. But at the older hospitals, it's people giving birth in parking lots and stuff like that. And in the oncology department on floor -3.
Well, it should all go smoothly and peacefully and quietly, God willing. What's the latest on the Iran negotiations and whether or not we're heading back to another round of high-intensity conflict?
The last thing that happened with Iran talks before we're recording on Tuesday, basically, is that President Trump is said to be considering Iran's suggestion that they only talk about reopening the Straits of Hormuz and not talk about the nuclear issue. But after the assassination attempt on Trump this weekend, his initial statement that he gave, which of course was mostly about the assassination attempt and things like that, but he was like, I'm trying to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. And I found that really interesting that was something that he mentioned in this speech, which I'm sure is not off the cuff. I'm sure he prepared somewhat with his aides, but it happened very soon after this event. And the fact that he chose to emphasize that tells me that I just think it's really unlikely that he would accept a suggestion from Iran to drop the nuclear issue.
I think you're right. And I think obviously the nuclear issue, the enriched uranium, is critical. Though there is an interesting argument to be made that with regards to the enriched uranium, which is certainly that which is buried underground, or the sites which are relatively well known, if Israel or the United States sees an Iranian attempt to remove the enriched uranium to enrich it to weapons grade, they'll be able to see that and they'll have time to act. Whereas if the United States now removes the economic sanctions, frees up billions of dollars in Iranian funds being held, that will give the regime a vital lifeline. Whereas right now, there are all kinds of reports on shortages in Tehran, inflation. We haven't seen massive protests yet, but it definitely seems that the government, the regime, is not able to provide or soon won't be able to provide important necessities and services to the population. So in some ways, I actually think that keeping up the economic pressure on, because the only real way to solve the issue is with regime change or creating the conditions for regime change.
Yeah.
What's actually most important is to keep up the economic pressure on the regime. And that actually might even be more important in sort of the near midterm than removing the enriched uranium.
It's an interesting thought. It's an interesting way of looking at it. My concern right now is that things are just going to stop in the middle, that this is just going to be like a frozen conflict with no agreement moving forward, which I guess in effect will mean what you're saying, right? Because there's already sanctions on Iran, so the sanctions will continue to be in place and nobody's going in to get that uranium. But these things take time. They're like a process. And it's not like the regime is going to change next month in all likelihood. And so my concern is what can happen with that uranium in the interim. Like, yes, we have pretty good intelligence in Iran. On the other hand, there's other people in charge now. And so what is the quality of intelligence at the moment in this time of upheaval, this time of instability? I don't have the answers to those questions, but there are definitely concerns.
With regards to the Iranian threat, there was also a very interesting report that Israel had provided the UAE with the Iron Dome battery during the Iran war for the very first time that Israel provided a country outside of Israel or the United States with the Iron Dome. Without going into details, I know that Israel provided the UAE with other capabilities, other advanced capabilities as well. And I think this is really important, both from an Abraham Accords perspective. We're looking at, it's just fascinating, we just sort of crunched the numbers. And 2025, in fact, if you look at Israel's trade with all of its Abraham Accords and peace partners, so UAE, Bahrain, Morocco, Egypt, Jordan, in 2025 was a record-breaking year. So 2024 was higher than 2023 in terms of trade. 2025 was actually slightly higher than 2024. But looking at it from a security perspective and establishing this new Middle East security architecture, air defense. So I believe in January, CENTCOM set up for the first time an integrated air defense cell within CENTCOM headquarters, and Israel is certainly integrated into that. But even beyond the Abraham Accords implications, I think it also reflects Israel's newfound self-image and status as a regional superpower. Because what does a regional superpower does? It changes the realities on its borders to ensure its security, which we're seeing in Gaza and Lebanon and Syria. It protects its allies. For example, the way that we saw that Israel protected the Jewish communities in southern Syria, but also it moves capabilities and systems around the region in order to ensure its interests and to protect its allies. And moving the Iron Dome to the UAE was meant, obviously, first and foremost, to protect the UAE, but was also a symbol of Israel's capabilities to be a real force for itself and for its allies in the region.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a really positive move. I think that diplomatically and just for the future of a more integrated region, this shows people that, you know, Israel does actually stand up for its friends and that it's worthwhile to be an ally of Israel. So I hope that this will encourage other countries to want to join the Abraham Accords. And the UAE have just proven to be really good friends to Israel throughout this whole period. I mean, the Abraham Accords, especially in the UAE, but also in other countries, have really sort of paid off. I saw a great joke about this once this news came out, which is that, like, imagine, I mean, it's not even a joke, it's true. Like, imagine you're in reserve duty, you know, and they say, where are you going for reserve duty? To Dubai, you know?
Which is probably better than Lebanon or Syria or Gaza, right? Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Like, it's much better than being in Binj Bel or whatever. Dir El Balah.
It's a good point.
Yeah.
We're hearing a different rhetoric coming from the UAE, from some of its leaders or influential figures, people like Anwar Gargash. Iran attacked, I think, 10 Arab League countries in this last operation, this last war, and the Arab League did almost nothing. And even the GCC, the various GCC countries themselves, took action, but the GCC as a whole was not a very effective group. And I think going forward, the UAE, but also other countries in the region are going to say, okay, how do I form the alliances and the partnerships that are going to ensure my security rather than relying on these old frameworks that didn't prove themselves when the, you know, the hit the fan when they were needed?
Yeah, I mean, you look, if you want to be like forward looking about it, like there's so much potential for cooperation that's good for these countries, like both economically and putting pressure on Iran, like just the example of the IMEC.
The India and Middle East Europe Corridor. Yeah.
Thank you. From, I know you've written extensively about it. I've written quite a bit too. It goes from India to Europe via the Middle East. It's supposed to go through the UAE and Saudi Arabia and go to Israel. Right now, no matter what happens with the Strait of Hormuz, like the fact that Iran has always had this capability, right? And they've threatened it for decades. But now that we know that Iran is willing to pull the trigger and really block the Strait of Hormuz, Arab Gulf states are really looking for ways to get around it and not have to use the Strait of Hormuz. And the IMEC, I think, will be a really good way to do that. Now, at this point, it does look like Saudi Arabia might be looking at going through Egypt and then to Europe and not through Israel. And I think that Israel has to try to encourage them to work with the original plan and go through Israel. And I think that the Saudis probably knew. The fact that it became public this week doesn't mean the Saudis found out this week. But the knowledge that, you know, Israel is such a good ally at a time of need might encourage them to work more with Israel.
Now, looking at another world conflict, this time a little further from the region, which somehow Israel has gotten itself once again mixed up in, there are reports of Ukrainian protests and even sanctions against Israel for Israel presumably accepting shipments of whether it's stolen wheat or wheat from territory that Russia's occupying in Ukraine. Lev, can you explain to us what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, the terms the Ukrainians use is stolen wheat, because it comes from parts of Ukraine that are occupied by Russia. But there are shipments of wheat on the way to Israel, and there have been shipments on the past, again, reportedly, that came from these areas. Ukraine considers it stolen. I'm looking now at a tweet from Zelensky from a few hours before we're recording this, where he says, purchasing stolen goods is an act that entails legal liability. And he says, based on information from our intelligence services, Ukraine is preparing a sanctions package that will cover both those directly transporting this grain and the individuals and legal entities attempting to profit from this criminal scheme. The EU is also threatening sanctions on anyone involved in the grain shipments. On the other hand, Israel says nobody's given us any evidence that this grain is stolen. Like, so if you're going to threaten us, like, at least give us evidence. And also just as like, why are you conducting this over social media? Which to me is like, you know, and not the proper channels. So I don't know if it went through the proper channels or not, but I will say for sure, Israel conducts a lot of its diplomacy over social media too. So that part I was like, fine. but Gideon Saar said, and again, I just opened his tweet, evidence substantiating the allegations have yet to be provided. You did not submit a request for legal assistance before turning to the media and social networks. The matter will be examined. So, you know, from Israel's point of view, I think we still have to wait and see what Israel's saying, whether, you know, what action they plan to take, if any. But this has become like a huge diplomatic storm. I mentioned the EU threatened to say also sanctions on anyone involved in these shipments, which I thought was, to be delicate, I'll call it ironic, because so many EU countries are buying gas from Russia. And I did point this out online, and a lot of people answered me sort of like, well, they have no choice. Well, Israel doesn't really grow its own wheat either. So if they have no choice but to get gas from Russia, when they could be buying gas, or they could be buying oil from many other countries in the world. I'm sure Trump would be thrilled if they wanted to buy oil from the U.S. Then why can't Israel do it, you know? And I'm not saying it's a good thing to do. That's the thing. It's like, I'm very much, at least in the Russia-Ukraine war, I am very much on Ukraine's side. But the hypocrisy can drive a person crazy. I mean, the all of these people, I saw, you know, Adam Kinzinger is a former member of Congress, but like, so not really that important, but like somebody who has influence and like a voice that a lot of people listen to on this topic, like he was saying, like, Israel can't claim to be an ally of democracies. Really? Like, really? Go talk to Germany first.
Absolutely. And Israel has been trying, even though it's expressed support for Ukraine, it has been trying to walk this sort of tightrope because of its very important relations with Russia, not just in terms of importing grain, but in terms of Russia's military interests all in areas all around its borders. So it has been trying to maintain good ties with both sides. But I think you're right in terms of the hypocrisy that we've seen in the EU. By the way, apropos EU sanctions on Israel, which they've been threatening to do, whatever you thought of Viktor Orban, I think that Israel is soon going to very much miss the Hungarian veto, if it's indeed not used, once the EU comes together again and tries to put on further sanctions onto Israel. Yeah.
That's true. We didn't discuss that election when it happened. And I think Israel is going to have a problem because usually Hungary and the Czech Republic would veto together. But the Czech Republic's style is not to antagonize the EU in general, something that Orban didn't care about either way. And so I don't think that the Czech Republic's going to go it alone. And it seems that the new guy, Matyar, it doesn't want to be the one guy going against the EU consensus. So Israel's going to have a lot more trouble in the EU coming up.
Now, the other big story this week was the political developments, maneuverings, new coalitions that were being set up among the Israeli opposition. Lav, what are your thoughts on the Bennett Lapid merger and the political developments more generally?
You know, Prime Minister Netanyahu has this very famous quip from 2019. I looked it up earlier today, where he says, "I don't intervene in the way the left divides up its votes." I'm not saying Bennett is left, even Lapid is probably more centrist. But I do think that this is a internal game inside the anti-Netanyahu bloc, which is sort of what Netanyahu was saying, right? He wasn't referring to them, he was referring to other things at the time. But I don't think that this is going to solve their problem. And their problem being that while in many polls, the the Zionist opposition, we'll call them that, because it's opposition parties that are Zionist. I don't think the Zionist opposition has enough seats in almost any poll, really, to form a majority. And they're not succeeding in peeling off right-wing voters from the pro-Netanyahu bloc, which also in most polls does not have a majority. Like, in the end, the Arab parties, I don't want to say that they're the kingmakers because I don't necessarily think they are going to be invited into the next coalition, and I can explain why after, but they're the ones who are keeping either side from having a majority. You just look at the polls, the previous polls before this merger, but also six different news outlets took out a poll after that announcement, so I actually made myself a chart of all of them. You look at the polls and there's no evidence that right-wing voters are moving to Bennett. And I think part of it is because he campaigned as a right-wing candidate in 2021 and then didn't govern like one when he became prime minister. And then when he brings in Lapid, who's to his left, that he's even less likely to attract right-wing voters. So at the end of the day, what Bennett did here is to solidify himself as the leading opponent to Netanyahu. But I don't think that this is the move that's going to win them the election. It's only the move that makes him stronger than Gadi Eisenkot.
It's going to win him the opposition, at least for now.
Right.
There's also talk of what the media here likes to call Likud Bet, Likud B, which is another party of former Likud figures, current Likud figures who are considered sort of rebels against Netanyahu's leadership, particularly on the Haredi draft issue. I don't know, you know, to what extent there's actual things that are happening, or if it's just talk, it's just headlines and spin and people testing the waters. There does seem to me to be a significant block of voters who see themselves as right-wing, who wouldn't vote for a Bennett-Lapid coalition or even for Eisenkot, but who strongly disagree with the Likud's position on the Haredi draft issue and think that the ultra-Orthodox need to be drafted and need to be sanctioned if they're not drafted. Maybe you know better than I do, but no, there seems to be at least 6, 7, 8 seats there, which may end up going to Lieberman's party. But people who are looking for that alternative, who are fed up on the ultra-Orthodox issue, see themselves as right-wing and are looking for who to vote for. One other point that I want to make, because often people, sometimes people abroad don't quite understand it. There are people who say, look, Netanyahu was prime minister on October 7th, the current coalition was in the government, therefore they have responsibility, and therefore they should not be in power. The electorate should elect somebody else. I think there's actually two different questions that there's lots of questions that Israeli voters ask themselves. One question is, does Netanyahu, does the government bear responsibility for October 7th? Well, they were certainly in power. Nobody debates that. But the other question is people look around and say, okay, currently, when I consider my current security and the diplomatic and economy and personal security, do I think that these other people are going to do a better job? And I think there are voters who say, you know, I may think Netanyahu is at blame, but when I look at the alternatives, I still would prefer Netanyahu to be in the prime minister seat than anybody else. I think it's important to understand that dynamic if you want to understand the relative stability of the two different blocks, the opposition and the coalition voting blocks.
Right. And you see that a lot of times the polls will ask people, who do you think is a better fit for prime minister? And then, because, you know, in an election in Israel, you don't actually vote for prime minister, you vote for a party. But the polling will sometimes ask that question. And in recent polls, Netanyahu has gotten the plurality of the votes all the time. Now, it's a plurality, not a majority. In the most recent one that I saw, he didn't get more than 44% in any head-to-head matchup with any candidate. But it's still, I think that, well, it reflects two things. Number one, the opposition to him is divided, and therefore all of the people who think that he's not a good fit, they have a lot of different choices of who they would pick. But I think it just reflects that a lot of people see Netanyahu as the lesser evil. I mean, he has plenty of people who just like him. They just support him. But I think there's a lot of people who just look at the people on the other side and don't think that they're serious candidates. It's subjective. It's totally subjective. I mean, a lot of people there have very good resumes, and it's unrealistic to expect anyone to have Netanyahu's resume because he's been around for so long.
We have a fantastic guest this week, member of Knesset Dan Eluz from the Likud party, who in fact is somebody who has taken very principled stances, sometimes in opposition to his party stance, and we get into that as well. But first,
this is the Misgav Institute for National Security's Mideast Horizons, the podcast for anyone who wants to truly understand what's happening in the Middle East beyond the headlines and spin. I'm Lav Harkov, your co-host, a Misgav Institute Senior Fellow and Senior Political Correspondent for Jewish Insider.
And I'm Asher Fredman, Executive Director of the Misgav Institute and a Visiting Fellow at the Heritage Foundation. The Misgav Institute is Israel's leading national security policy center, dedicated to strengthening Israel's security, its regional integration, and its international alliances and standing. And each week here on Mideast Horizons, we go beyond the noise and the headlines to bring you fresh insights into the most important events and developments on the Israel-Middle East national security agenda.
Please subscribe and follow wherever you listen to podcasts to keep up to date and ahead of the curve on everything connected to the Middle East. You can reach out to us with comments and suggestions at MideastHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com.
Please keep sending your comments. We read them. We can also sign up to receive Israel in 10, the Misgav Daily Brief, where we give you all the main headlines, plus expert insights and interviews from Israel and the Middle East in just 10 minutes. In fact, yesterday, Lab, you were our guest. You've been before. And we'll drop a link to that sign up in the show notes as well. This week's guest is member of Knesset Dan Eluz. Dan Eluz has been serving in the Knesset, Israel's parliament, since January 2023 as a member of the Likud party. He is the chair of the Knesset's Abraham Accords Caucus, as well as the head of the Knesset delegation to the Interparliamentary Union. He previously served as a member of the Knesset's influential Foreign Affairs and Defense Committee and Economic Committee, but was removed from those committees by his own party due to his principled stance on the issue of the ultra-Orthodox draft. And that's, of course, something that we get into in this conversation, the whole issue of the Haredi ultra-Orthodox draft. Dan served from 2018 to 2021 as a member of the Jerusalem City Council. He grew up in Montreal, Canada, to parents who both came to Canada from Morocco. And after studying law in Canada, he moved to Israel in 2009, where he served as an officer in the IDF, and then began his career promoting Zionism, Israel's security, sovereignty, free market reforms, and much more. So without further ado, please enjoy this wide-ranging conversation with member of Knesset, Dan Eluz. Member of Knesset Dan Eluz, welcome to Mideast Horizons. It's great to have you on the podcast.
Thank you so much.
You've been a member of Knesset for 3 years now. There aren't many members of Knesset who are relatively new immigrants to Israel, who come from an English-speaking background, a Canadian background. Tell us your impressions, your experiences, 3 years of being in the Knesset, which is a very, very vibrant democracy, house of democracy.
And that's probably the biggest understatement that you've made there in a long time. The Israeli Knesset is well known for the dynamic nature of the debates that there are over here. Let's put it this way. When you go through the Knesset, then you understand that Israel's democracy is very, very vibrant. And then anyone who puts that to question is really not being an honest person. The debates here are very vibrant, very intense. I will say sometimes as Westerners who like, I don't want to put down Israeli culture, but let's call it, we have our own tradition of what we call civilized debate. Then sometimes there is a level of shock to the way things get done over here.
Unfortunately, the British, when they left, they didn't leave us their culture of understanding.
I have to say that the British also have their way of doing debates. That is, if you ever see the British Parliament, then it's quite, it's also quite different than the Canadian politeness that I grew up on.
It's fun, you know, in Israel, people like to talk about being like Ashkenazi Sephardi or Ashkenazi Mizrahi, but you buck that stereotype entirely because you're Moroccan Canadian.
So yeah, I get the politeness from the Canadian part, but I also get the chutzpah, I guess, from the the Moroccan part. I want to say that I think that especially after things that we've gone through in the last few years as a society in Israel, that the voice that I bring to the Knesset, which is, let's say, more polite, more very ideological, but uses a different tone in order to present that voice. I think it's something that actually Israelis appreciate also. There's a lot of people that are looking for that. Definitely after October 7 and after all the very strong debates that there were on the judicial reform, this is something that Israelis were looking for. I hope that they keep on looking for that, even though we see some digression lately, going back each one in their own camps and starting again, attacking each other's camp one to the other. But I hope that we keep on looking for that more uniting voice, because I think that's needed very, very strongly for Israel. If we're united, then we can do anything in Israel. But unfortunately, sometimes we go back to those very petty debates and we forget that we need to first be one Jewish nation and afterwards have our arguments. We're pros at arguing, Jews, right? But we can do that while still being united.
So let's talk about one of the big arguments you've been involved in, which is about the draft for Haredi Israelis. You have been one of the prominent voices within Likud calling for a more equal treatment of the Haredim compared to other Jewish Israelis. First of all, I want to know what that's like being, you know, one of a handful of voices in a big party that is mostly willing to do what the Haredim want to keep the coalition together. I'm sure there's a lot of pressure there. And then I'd like to know what you do actually think will bring more ultra-Orthodox young men into the army.
So about your first question, I'll say very frankly and bluntly that I didn't come to politics just in order to sit in a nice chair and have a good time and then say that I was a member of Knesset. As someone who moved to Israel out of Zionism, I left a very promising career after I finished McGill Law School at age 23 and decided to leave everything. And when my friends just suited up and went to the big law firms all around the world, I decided to move to Israel and I put on a different suit. I put on an IDF uniform and joined the army. And I did that out of Zionism. And this is what led me afterwards also to join the public service, first of all, on a municipal level as a member of the Jerusalem City Council, and then afterwards also to run for national office in the Likud. And so I know what it is to go because of ideals, because of things you believe in, and go all the way and sacrifice many things. And so after joining the Knesset, it was very clear for me that what I would do is try to be the moral voice, the ethical voice, the voice that brings the ideals of the Likud to the forefront, and not just play along in order to survive politically. And that's what I've done. The Likud is a Zionist party. The Likud is a right-wing free market party that believes in what we call here in Israel liberal national values. Americans, usually they hear liberal, they think it means left-wing, but no, we're talking about classical liberalism, free markets, less government intervention, definitely equality before the law. And all of these values are what push me to take a very firm stance on many different issues. And as you said, the most public one has been the draft issue. I basically understand today, after October 7th, that the issue of the relationship between the ultra-Orthodox and the state of Israel is really an existential issue for Israel. It's true on the level of the draft. And that has to do with our security, with the size of our army, with the fact that we just simply need soldiers in order to fight all of these wars and all of these fronts that we've been fighting. It's true also economically, and that's maybe less of the radar on the radar on a very immediate level. But in the long term, if the demographics continue the way they exist today, and Israel's demographics basically, they're growing in all sectors, which is an anomaly in the Western world. Even their secular Jews are still growing, which is a blessing. It means that really people have, usually demographic researchers say that this is a sign of optimism as to where society is growing. And the fact that Israel that's going through such wars is still very an optimistic society is something incredible. But when we're looking at the Haredi sector, they're growing much more, exponentially more than the secular and religious Zionist sectors. And so we know that the demographic reality means that the Haredi community is going to take a very large chunk of what Israeli society is and eventually maybe even become a majority. And with this demographic reality in front of us, and I'm not trying to change this demographic reality, I'm just trying to say that with this demographic reality in front of us, we need to understand that if they do not take part in military service, and also if they do not take part in the economic sector, the way they should in the same numbers as other sectors, then Israel won't be able to be the same state economically. We won't be the startup nation. We won't have the same economic strength that we have right now. We won't have the same army that we have right now. And when we understand the threats Israel is facing, then that's an existential threat. Is if Israel cannot be strong economically and cannot have a strong army, then Israel cannot be. And therefore, I understand that this is an existential issue. And on existential issues, from day one, I decided that I'll put a red line. And even if my party goes the other way, then I'll make it very clear that I'm going to put a red line and say that we need to make a very clear statement that this political considerations can be the reason we just say okay to existential threats. Political considerations aren't good enough for that. And so that's the reason why I took such a strong stance.
Dana, I really want to say, you know, I've been so impressed by your political career, not just because I happen to, I think, agree with you on many of your positions, but also because of this principled stance. And you know, you've been punished by the Likud. I think you lost your seat on the Foreign Affairs and Defense Committee and the Economic Committee because you sort of refused to take the easy route and go along with legislation that is essentially would have removed any kinds of penalties or removed incentives on the ultra-Orthodox to take a draft. And really, I think that your principled stance is something to be admired and replicated. I want to ask you something because you said the Likud is a liberal party in the classic sense, but it seems to me that there are sort of really almost two different Likuds in the ruling party. You have the free market liberal element, and then you have kind of a socialist populist element, and you see they find expression on all kinds of issues related to imports and regulation and your government bureaucracy and the degree to which elected representatives have decision-making power as opposed to bureaucrats. What do you think in terms of the Likud and the current government and the ruling coalition, which side is the more dominant one, the one that in the end is setting the economic agenda for Israel?
So I have to be honest and frank with you guys. I think that the situation right now is that over the past few decades, the Likud knew how to be a big tent that held many different types of people that joined together for different reasons. By the way, it existed in every right-wing party all around the world. Reagan called it the three-legged stool, where the conservative movement, as he called it, the conservative politically, right, had three legs holding it up together. The economic leg, which was free markets, the foreign policy defense leg, which was being more hawkish on foreign policy and defense, and the leg which was on moral issues, let's call it this way, of being conservative socially. And he said that if you take a leg from the three-legged stool, then the stool falls. Now, obviously, different people have different reasons why they joined the conservative movement. So, some were conservative fiscally, some were conservative because of foreign affairs, and some were conservative because they're Christian evangelicals and they believed in social conservatism, but they knew how to work together. And in Israel, we have the same dynamic. By the way, also historically, it's different groups that actually joined together. You had the Liberalim, that was a party that was free markets. You had Chirut, that was more when it comes to foreign policy, Begin's party, who cared less about economics, to be honest. But he had free market instincts, and Jabotinsky was definitely a free marketer, but the Chirut party was much more focused on foreign policy. And you had then the, I would say, the Masorti population that was much more invested in what had to do with the Jewish character of Israel. They all came together in Likud. Machal, the Likud, is actually, Likud means coming together. It's actually three different parts that came together. I have to say that, to be very honest, that I think that the primary is coming up, whenever the elections will be, then 2 months before we'll have primaries, will be a very big test for the Likud as to whether it still knows how to bring all of these populations together. I will be very honest. I sometimes feel that I am a lone voice on some issues, fighting in order to keep this population within this party. But I think that without this population, then the Likud will lose many, many votes and will lose many, many voters that are looking for a right-wing, liberal, free market party that the Likud knew to represent also. I have to say specifically, Benjamin Netanyahu, who came from these areas, originally he grew up as a free marketer, as a liberal, again, liberal in the classical sense, right? American listeners understand that in Israel, liberal means what liberal means in
a capitalist.
UK. Yeah, in the UK and in Europe, not what it means in the United States. It means Reagan and Thatcher. That's what liberal means in Israel. And so in this sense, that's where he grew up. That's how he came to power. Now, for political reasons, and because he's prime minister and doesn't necessarily deal with all of these things on a day-to-day basis, he really looks more at foreign policy and things. So he's less involved with these issues. But I think that if the Likud ends up going to a populist, socialist, and more than that, even like becoming a party that brings together a lot of interest groups that join the party just in order to advance their interests, then we're just going to lose this election and many elections after that. And so I think that sticking to our values is something which is very important, and that's what I try to do.
I mean, it's interesting because it almost feels like things bifurcated in the sense that the national security right is sort of firmly on the right, like in this current coalition. But then the economic right is sort of floating all over the place. Like, you have people in the opposition who are probably more to the economic, not all of the opposition, for sure not, but certain groups in the opposition that are more economically right than a lot of the Likud these days. I mean, they've really stopped.
You can put things on the table. You have in the coalition parties like Shas, which are completely socialist. They're very far left.
Yeah.
When it comes to economics, you have Yadut HaTorah also.
Exactly.
And and within Likud and within Tzionut Datit, you have different voices. And yes, Sasson Gweta, who's my colleague, who came into politics in order to save the farmers from free market reforms, is a complete socialist. And he says it himself. He says he agrees on economics with Nama Razimi. Now, your listeners might not know who Nama Razimi is, but she's basically the more far left.
She's like the AOC of the Knesset.
Basically, she's as far left as you can be. And so he says that economically he sees eye to eye with her. And so, yes, to me, that's a problem that needs to be fixed within the Likud. And I, with all my love for him on a personal level, I hope he doesn't pass the next primaries. But if the Likud decides to go this way, I think it will be a very big problem for the party. Now, I think that part of the problem, I don't know how deeply within Likud politics you want me to get, but part of the problem is that because we've been in power for so long, and because it's a trend you see all around the world, by the way, but when a party is in power for a very long time, then interest groups understand that the way for them to influence is to join the party in power. And then the party in power becomes a dynamic where you have some people that are there for ideological reasons, but many, many people that are there also because they just want to advance their interest. And it can be unions that, again, unions joining a capitalist party is something ridiculous, right? But it happened in Israel because they understand that that's where their power is. So they joined the Likud because they understand that's where the power is, and they amassed more and more power. It's true also for, again, farmers, which I have nothing against farming. I think farming is a Zionist ideal. I think it's amazing. But I think that the way farmers are organized right now in what they call muatzot, which basically when you translate muatzot to Russian, it actually is translated to Soviet, and that's what muatzot means in Russian. It's basically committees that decide how that sector can be organized, who can produce what, and how much they can produce. That's complete socialism.
And price controls.
Price controls. That's completely.
And it actually leads to milk not being on the shelves of supermarkets, which is crazy.
Exactly.
2026.
So instead of directly supporting farmers, which I would be pro, because even though I'm a capitalist, I think that there are things that the government can invest in, and it's logical, both for security reasons and also for Zionist idealistic reasons. And farming is a Zionist ideal in my eyes. So I would be pro direct subsidies. I'm pro that, but that's not the way those farmers are going. They're going through closing the market, stopping any competition, and keeping basically the power that they have amassed over the years in their hands. It's also with I have a bill to bring Uber in Israel, something that should have been done maybe 10 years ago, right? I mean, all around the world, he had that argument 10 years ago. In Israel, he have it today because me and other MKs proposed this bill right
well,
now.
Well, we so had we have, it 10 years ago too, but then Uber lost.
Uber lost, you're right. And now we have the same fight again. If you go on my social media, you'll see that many, many, many taxi drivers are threatening me politically. Again, I by the way, I think that they don't understand the bill. I think that the fact that they will not be controlled by
taxi stations.
Yeah. Taxi stations that basically give them their work will only free them. They'll be able to use applications like Uber the same way anyone. Yeah, it's true. They'll have other competition, but it will free them from the taxi station. So I think it's actually good for them. But anyways, that's not the story. The story is that you have those taxi drivers that are trying to use political power that they have as Likud members in order to stop free market reforms that happened everywhere in the world when the party is in power for very long. I think that if we cave into these interest groups, then the Likud will not be Likud anymore, and it will, again, it will lose a lot of power politically, electorally, definitely on the day after Netanyahu, because Netanyahu still has this clout where he gets to bring certain voters that are very loyal to him. But on the day after, when people will start looking at different alternatives, I don't think that a group of interest groups is going to be something very attractive to them.
I want to go to another piece of legislation that you're advancing, which I think is long past overdue, which was the legislation to stop the activity of UNRWA within Israel, right? As people probably know UNRWA is the UN agency dedicated to, I wouldn't even say Palestinian refugees, dedicated to the descendants of the descendants of Palestinian refugees who still maintain the hope of returning to their former homes and essentially erasing the Jewish state from the map. This agency has been active throughout Israel, throughout Judea and Samaria, throughout the Gaza, and you put forward legislation that was meant to end their activities here in Israel. So first, you can just tell us where that stands. I mean, has this legislation been implemented? What are you doing to oversee it? And why do you think it's so important?
So first of all, the good news is that it's almost fully implemented today. There were two pieces of legislation that passed simultaneously. One was to stop UNRWA from operating anywhere on sovereign Israeli land. So I have to be specific. Sovereign Israeli land does not include Judea and Samaria and Gaza, unfortunately. Even though I'm a big proponent of applying sovereignty in these areas, it hasn't been done yet, but it does include Jerusalem. And so we had a lot of challenges in applying it in certain areas in Jerusalem. I'll get back to that in a second. The second piece of legislation was trying to basically put a chokehold on UNRWA and the other places, which is Judea and Samaria and Gaza. The idea was basically to say that it's illegal for any Israeli or Israeli body to be in touch with UNRWA. It includes the Israeli government, it includes ministries, and so it would be illegal for the Ministry of Interior, for example, to give visas to UNRWA workers coming through Israel to Gaza. That's one example. It would be illegal for the army to coordinate with UNRWA. That's another example. All of these things would be illegal, and so slowly, quicker than slowly, hopefully, but still at least slowly, UNRWA would make it impossible for UNRWA to still act in Gaza and in Judea and Samaria. So again, as I said, the second piece of legislation, it's taking more time. There's still some UNRWA presence in Gaza and in Judea and Samaria, but the law is being applied. And I have to say that UNRWA is not what it used to be. It's definitely not as strong as it used to be in Judea and Samaria and in Gaza. It's become pretty much meaningless and just a way to do things that other organizations ask them to do in order to help out. It's not the main super force that it used to be in the past. When it comes to presence in Jerusalem specifically, we had challenges over time, but I'm happy to say that UNRWA's locations all around Jerusalem right now have been basically evacuated, except for one location, which because the army has been very involved in military action in Lebanon, in Iran, in Gaza, the focus has been very on other places. And so the army asked to take it a little slower when it comes to evacuating the compound, which is in an area which would take military action in order to evacuate, because it's more delicate. It's on what we call the other side of the fence. When it comes, it's still Jerusalem's sovereign territory, but the fence that was established by Sharon actually cuts Jerusalem in some areas, and the other side of the fence is places which over the years have become very, very difficult for Israelis to go in. The Jerusalem municipality almost never goes in there because it's become very problematic security-wise. That's a whole issue on its own. It's honestly something that shouldn't have happened, but it happened. That's not our topic of discussion. But the army at some point will have to go in and evacuate that location also.
I'm interested in looking at this in the macro level. Like, do you think that this has made a change in the relationship to the Palestinians and what's happening in Gaza? Like, well, what has been the impact of this?
So it's a very good question. And I don't think that there's anyone that expected that impact to be immediate. But when you have a lot, I mean, you know, billions of dollars that are going into Gaza, the question of who is handling this money is critical. If it's a group that sees generation after generation of Palestinians as refugees, even though that's a unique definition only applied to Palestinians, then that's a problem. It makes the problem persist, not solve the problem. They don't rehabilitate Palestinians. They just keep them as refugees generation after generation. If it's a group, a body that sees the right of return as something that should be pushed, right, the right of return of Palestinians to sovereign Israel, and thus making Israel basically not a Jewish state anymore, then demographically, right, by bringing millions of Palestinians into Israel proper, then that is something which long term is a problem. If it's a body that gets money to educate Palestinians and then teaches them textbooks that promotes terrorism, then it doesn't solve the problem. It just creates more terrorism. And so
you also have to remember that UNRWA workers and facilities were directly involved in the October 7th terror attack.
That's the trigger that usually helps international community understand why UNRWA is such a problem. But I'm saying the problem is much deeper. This is the surface. The fact that they engaged in October 7th atrocities, that basically the tip of the iceberg that everyone saw. But what's been happening beneath the water is much greater. It's a very toxic organization that basically the bottom line is that UNRWA's conclusion, if you take all of UNRWA's statements, the conclusion is that Israel isn't supposed to exist, basically, but the right of return, educating for terror, etc. And so having other organizations that actually, the model that we were pushing for is not that there shouldn't be humanitarian aid or things like that to Palestinians who actually do deserve humanitarian aid, right? Not the terrorists, but people who do deserve humanitarian aid. But that's international organizations that deal with crisis regions all around the world should be dealing with it also in Gaza and in Judea and Samaria, and not... or maybe in Judea and Samaria even have the Palestinian Authority. I'm against the Palestinian Authority. I don't think that it should exist, right? But if you already have it, then there's no reason to have both UNRWA and the Palestinian Authority. It doesn't make any sense. And so the argument we made is that the models that exist all around the world should exist also here. And there's no reason for a special organization that deals only with the conflict and only with the Palestinians and then adopts the Palestinian narrative and pushes it also to exist. And so I don't think that you can see immediate positive developments, but I do still believe that in the long term it will have some very, very deep effects. I do want to say that what people threatened us with, I mean, every single initiator of this bill got called by a lot of embassies from all around the world saying this is a red line, you cannot deal with international organizations, if you do that then Israel will be seen as a blah blah blah, etc. there will be diplomatic repercussions. Those threats didn't actually actualize, right? They didn't happen. We passed the law, we ignored the threats, people said no, and then we just moved ahead, and that didn't actually cause any great diplomatic crisis the way people said that would happen. And so I think that on a cost-benefit analysis, that the long-term benefits that I envision will come from this law are definitely greater than the short-term costs that really were just declarative and nothing substantive that happened.
It's a good point also because not only has the United States ended its funding for UNRWA, but to be honest, over the last decade, Arab countries, GCC countries, have greatly decreased their funding for UNRWA. It was primarily Western European, Scandinavian countries that were continuing to fund this organization that was perpetuating the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. In your even additional role as your chair of the Abraham Accords Caucus, or co-chair of the Abraham Accords Caucus in the Knesset, and I believe you've been to the UAE, to Bahrain, obviously to Morocco, which is where your family is originally from. What are Abraham Accords-related areas where you think there's still potential that hasn't been realized for ties between Israel and its Abraham Accords partners or other countries in the region?
Well, there's a lot of countries in the region that we have a lot of potential for relations with. I think that the Iran war highlighted that. I think of the fact that Iran attacked all the Gulf countries, including the Saudis, was maybe the stupidest thing they could do, to be honest. I mean, okay, I understand what they were trying to say. They were trying to tell the world that if America and Israel attacks, then there will be a price to everyone. So they try to get those countries to pressure Israel and America to stop. But I think that it had the complete opposite effect. And to be honest, I think it was foreseeable. It showed that Iran is the real threat and that all of the other countries are threatened by Iran much more than by Israel. And I have to say that I'm involved in international relations a lot. I represent Israel in international forums, including in the IPU, which is a forum where Israeli with parliament members from all around the world. And every single time you had Arab countries coming since the Gaza war, since October 7th, every single time you had the Arab group, that's how they call it. It actually includes Persians and Arabs. It's basically the Middle Eastern group, the Islamic group, however you want, the Muslim countries group, however you want to call it. It had a united declaration where they asked to condemn Israel for ABC. It was always something else. It never passed because, thank God, I was successful in stopping it by getting alliances with other countries, and we stopped it. It's actually the only international organization that I know that didn't condemn Israel since October 7th. So I'm very proud of that achievement because we managed to stop it. But the Arab group was united in the previous meeting that there was, which was only a few weeks ago. I didn't go to it because of security concerns. The Shabak didn't let me go to it. They said that I can't go to Turkey. It actually happened in Turkey. So they told me I can't go to Turkey right now because it's too dangerous. So anyways, I wasn't there physically, but I followed from far and I saw that there were two resolutions promoted by Arab or Muslim nations. One was only Iran, the only one signed on to it. And it condemned Israel and America for attacking Iran. But the other one was actually from Bahrain and joined by the Saudis and the Emiratis and all of these others, condemning Iran for attacking them. And so you see that in all of, and I spoke to some of my friends in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, in the UN, and in all of these different things. And you see a trend where the Arab countries are actually much less focused on condemning Israel, which already we knew that those new condemnations was basically, when the UAE condemns Israel now, to be honest, as Israelis, we don't take it so seriously because we know that they care about our relationship very, very deeply. And they understand that they just have to make those condemnations to be part of the Arab League, et cetera, et cetera. We don't take it very seriously, to be honest. I hope my friends in the UAE don't get insulted. I don't think they will get insulted. I think they will wink and say thank you. And so that was already a trend happening. But now we see an additional trend, which is much less condemnations of Israel and much more focus on how do we stop Iran. And it's becoming more explicit. The switch is becoming more explicit. And so I think that with this switch becoming more explicit, we'll see a lot of potential for other countries. Obviously, the Saudis are still the big prize. I'm not sure it will happen very soon, the Saudis. There are some stumbling blocks over there. But I think that the Iran war is actually fanning the flame and actually helping the Abraham Accords grow because it shows the common interest that we have. By the way, it also shows the economic interest that the world has because if the Abraham Accords had passed, we would have alternatives to the current blockade that the Iranians are trying to continue against international trade. And so we would have alternatives to that. And so I think that this war has actually shown how much potential there is for the Abraham Accords to grow.
This has been really great. And I want to ask you one more question before we go. You probably hear this question a lot, but what is your advice to new immigrants, to new Olim, who want to come to Israel and they want to make a difference? They want to make a real impact here like you have.
So first of all, I say something very important is that I think it's important to actually not say, oh, it's too difficult and stop. Because I think that Olim have a voice that is so important. We're talking about people, especially Olim, that come from countries where they decided to make Aliyah. I mean, every Aliyah is very important. And I think that the mosaic of cultures that we have in Israel is one of the most beautiful things that there is in Israel. Asher, I won't put you on the spot and I won't ask you to speak about your home, but I think that's part of what's beautiful in Israel, really. I think it's amazing. But I think that Olim that come from North American countries, Europe, countries where you decide to make Aliyah not out of difficulty, but out of Zionism, have an incredible message to give to Israel today, where many times the new generation asks itself, is it really worth it? Is it really worth all of the hardship? I mean, after October 7, we saw this huge wave of Zionism, right? We call it the victory generation here in Israel, Dor HaNitzachon, which is amazing. But you still have those voices which ask, wait, is it worth it? Should I not go look for an easier life somewhere else in Israel? So I think that this motivation that Olim bring is something incredible. And so I really call on them to try and take an active role in Israel's public service, however they do it, whether it's on a small voluntary level or make a career out of it. And I think the number one tip that I give every single Ole is learn Hebrew early, because it's really difficult. But if you have Hebrew, then you can do a lot more and you don't end up staying in your little bubbles. Which it might be easier, and I won't ever judge someone who makes Aliyah, which is something very difficult, and decides knowingly, I want to stay in that bubble because it's difficult enough, and so this is what makes it easier for me, then that's fine. But if you want to succeed in having a wider impact on Israeli society, then learning Hebrew is something which is really critical. And then you end up, when you learn Hebrew, then you take away the biggest disadvantage that Olim have, which is the lack of Hebrew, and you still have all of the advantages which Olim have, which is a very deep understanding of international relations, of international cultures, many times very strong academic background. Olim that come to Israel have a lot to offer Israeli societies, and they have a lot of advantages. The biggest disadvantage, there's two of them, it's Hebrew, which again, you can take care of it early on. It's important to invest in it, even if it means not starting to work early on and investing in Ulpan and all of these things. The second is the circles of what we call protektiot or connections or however you call it. But there I want to volunteer and tell anyone who wants to get involved, you can call me and I'd be happy to try and see how I can help you. I'll tell you, I just met.
That's why it's important to come young. Like if you're in your early 20s thinking about coming, it's so important to come then when you
definitely
make like long lasting friendships.
Definitely.
But I always say that it's true. In Israel, you need protection, you need connections, but you can make your own connections. I mean, in Israel, you can call up a minister and say, hey, can I meet you tomorrow?
True.
And that's like a totally normal thing to do.
Definitely. Definitely. I mean, I just met with someone, I won't say her name, obviously, but a few hours ago, just for that reason. She said, I'm very interested in public service. I come from Chutz Laaretz. I want to start getting involved. How do I do it? She just sent me a WhatsApp and we met a few hours ago. And it's fine. It's completely normal. And I agree. In other countries, I wouldn't think of sending a WhatsApp to my member of parliament in Canada. I imagine that members of Congress are also less accessible. But in Israel, it's very accepted.
Member of Knesset, Daniels, thank you so much for joining the podcast. It's been great. And thank you so much for everything that you're doing for the nation of Israel, for the state of Israel.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. Make sure to subscribe, like, and follow Misgav at misgavins.org. And of course, on social media. Send your comments, questions, and suggestions to MideastHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com. And thanks for listening.
See you next time.